From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers are leaving Washington for the 4th of July recess with no health care bill passed through the Senate, and senators on the fence will likely get an earful from constituents back home. So how are Americans feeling about health care and Washington? Well, a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll is out today. It finds President Trump's approval rating at a new low, just 37%. NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor is here with the details. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jeremy.
So while the president's popularity continues to wane, he does still have support of Republicans, right?
He is holding on to his base, and that's sort of one of the few things the White House can take solace in right now. Overall, we found that the president's approval rating is at 37%, and that's been about where he's been at for the past few months. For comparison, Obama's approval rating was at 56% in June 2009. So typically, presidents get a little bit of a honeymoon period. Now, Trump does have the approval of about 80% of Republicans, and those who identify themselves as strong Republican, he's at 91%. So with his core base, he's doing really well. And among people who voted for him last fall, 89% approve of the job he's doing.
How is he doing among various demographic groups? Are there any surprises there?
Well, there are some, you know, hints that maybe, you know, maybe not his traditional base could be eroding a little bit. White non-college educated voters were really key to his success last November, and his approval rating is just sort of barely above water with them. 52% say they approve of him, while 37% disapprove of the job he's doing. And among voters who are 60 or older, he's underwater as well. Only 43% of those voters approve of him, while 47% disapprove.
What about independents? How's he doing there?
This is, I think, one of the most interesting trends that we found. When we talk about, you know, how Trump is doing on the economy, they have largely sort of flipped and begun to erode on him just over the past few months. Just 31% of independents say they have confidence in Trump's ability to help the economy, and 49% doubt that he can sort of turn things around economically here. Now, when independents were asked the same question back in March, the numbers were reversed. 44% said that they had a positive outlook on his economic abilities, and just 38% said that they didn't.
Now, poll numbers matter to a certain degree, and one of the ways that they matter is that lawmakers look at them and say, well, I don't know if I want to support this person's agenda if they are so unpopular. But I'd also like to know, what did we find out about how people feel about the Senate health care bill as senators go back and ponder this very decision?
It's not very popular. And I think when you're dealing with an unpopular president and an unpopular Senate bill and an unpopular Congress, that's sort of a recipe for a disaster. And that's why, you know, we're seeing Republicans who control essentially all three branches of government having a tough time doing something. One in four people said that they didn't know enough about the bill, which, of course, was just released last week and now has been delayed voting on it until after the July 4th recess. But of those who did, 55% said they did not approve of the plan. They very much disapprove of it. And that includes 68% of independents. And even among Republicans that should be supporting this bill the most, only 35% said that they approve of the Senate bill.
What did it say about how people feel about Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act? We have to point that out because there are some people out there who think they're different things. They're not. How did Obamacare do?
You know, the trend line that we've seen for a while, even in other polls, is that this has gotten more popular, you know, over the past 7 years since it was first voted on and then implemented. So it has been gaining more steam. And we actually found that a plurality of Americans, 46%, actually want the bill to do more. They want it to be even more far-reaching. About a quarter of people want it repealed completely, and that includes over half of Republicans. So when you're talking about people that want it repealed, it is still a lot of the GOP base that feels very strongly about that. And about 17% of Americans just sort of want it to be left alone, nothing done to it.
Are there any things on which Americans agree in this poll?
I think when we're talking about sort of Americans more broadly, not a lot. I think that they agree that there is just not a good outlook of where America is right now. There is not a lot of confidence in institutions, whether that be the president, Congress, political parties. So it's sort of a really sour mood. If you've been feeling that across the country, then you're not alone.
That's NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor, and we will link you to more from the NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll at hereandnow.org. Jessica, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, now to the fight against ISIS. We've talked about the push against the group in Mosul in Iraq. ISIS is also losing its grip on its de facto capital in Syria, Raqqa. ISIS fighters being pushed deeper and deeper into small pockets of that city by U.S. airstrikes and Syrian Democratic Forces. CBS correspondent Holly Williams and her team are the first American television crew to report from inside Raqqa. In fact, they're among the few Western journalists who've been inside Syria. You can see their reporting at hereandnow.org. It's amazing. Earlier this week, as members of her team moved forward, they were spotted by ISIS snipers.
Our producer, Omar Abdulkader, had no choice but to make a run for it.
That was close.
They were safe, but pinned down by at least two snipers.
And Holly Williams joins us now by cell phone from Kobani on Syria's border with Turkey, about 75 miles from Raqqa. Holly, you were slightly behind your crew when they came under fire. There is great danger there.
Yeah, I was not actually with three of my team members as they moved forward in Raqqa. They were with the Syrian Democratic. We were all with the Syrian Democratic Forces inside Raqqa. Those fighters agreed to take three people forward. And so I was not with them. I was about 400 yards back. It was a pretty scary situation for them. They were spotted by at least two ISIS snipers, and they had to make a run for it to take cover.
Well, and it's clear that ISIS is still there.
They're absolutely still there. I mean, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who are America's allies on the ground here in Syria, in northeastern Syria, in the fight against ISIS, are rapidly taking back territory. Last week alone, they apparently took back 17 square miles. But the U.S. also says that there are about 2,500 ISIS fighters left inside Raqqa. And those are the parts of the city that we didn't see when we walked into Raqqa, where there are those fighters who are holed up, as well as tens of thousands of civilians.
And by the way, who are the Syrian Democratic Forces?
They are America's closest partners here in Syria. They are leading the fight on the ground against ISIS inside Syria. They are a Kurdish Arab coalition. There are about 45,000 of them, maybe more by now, and they are about two-thirds Kurdish. And they are dominated by a Kurdish militia group known as the YPG. Now, America is partnering with them because, frankly, they're the most effective force on the ground taking on ISIS. But it's a controversial move on the part of the U.S. because the YPG is very closely connected with another group over the border in Turkey known as the PKK, which is a terrorist group that is engaged in a long-running conflict with the Turkish state.
They're a separatist group that wants to separate from the Turkish state. Well, so what's endgame if you've got these Kurdish fighters primarily fighting to free Raqqa of ISIS? They still turn around and Assad is tightening his grip on Syria. So what's endgame there?
Yeah, I don't think there is an endgame at this point. There might be an endgame in sight to the territorial ambitions of ISIS. Remember, ISIS set up a so-called Islamic State, a caliphate, that extended from Syria all the way across into Iraq. And ISIS is now rapidly losing territory. Pretty soon, I think we can expect it to not control any territory at all. That doesn't mean that we've seen the back of ISIS. I think everyone expects ISIS to turn in to a kind of guerrilla organization, a terrorist group that continues to carry out attacks.
Yeah.
But it will no longer do so from its own territorial base. But this is not an end to the Syrian civil war, because remember, the Syrian civil war is multi-sided. We still have the Syrian regime and all the and the forces that support it. We still have the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are backed by the U.S., and then we still have the Syrian rebels.
And Russia and Iran backing the Assad regime as well. Look, you mentioned the civilians trapped in Raqqa. You may not have been in that moment earlier with your producer, but you walked through the city. We can see you. What can you tell us about the civilians?
Well, we didn't see any civilians. There was gunfire. There was fighting very obviously going on. There were airstrikes pummeling ISIS positions. But we didn't see a single civilian. It was just empty streets, empty houses, and this very battle-scarred neighborhood. Some houses, buildings destroyed by airstrikes, others, you know, pockmarked by artillery and mortars.
Well, do you think there are, you know, they are maybe huddled in basements or they're just gone? This is part of the refugee flow.
Yeah, I think in the neighborhood that we saw, which has been very recently reclaimed from ISIS, the civilians have long gone. They're in refugee camps, but by all reports, there are still tens of thousands of civilians inside Raqqa, inside the neighborhoods that are still controlled by ISIS.
CBS News correspondent Holly Williams speaking to us from Kobani, Syria, on the Turkish border after being the first American crew inside Raqqa. And as we said, Holly, one of the few crews in Syria. Please take care.
Thanks, Robin.
Summer has officially arrived. Yay, say about a kabillion kids. It's also time for summer reading assignments. Maybe less enthusiasm there. Well, our next guest has a solution, poetry. Author Kwame Alexander's wildly popular novel in verse, The Crossover, is about basketball and more. He's also got a new book out, The Playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game Called Life, something of a memoir. He joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Kwame, hi.
Hey, hey, what's happening?
Well, not much since we just saw you a little bit ago. You were in Boston, the featured speaker at the 826 Boston event. This is Dave Eggers' great writing organization for kids. I want you to talk a little bit about a video that you made. There was a kid that responded to your poetry?
Yes. So I wrote a novel called The Crossover, and I was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, doing a book signing for the new book, The Playbook. And so after the signing, this woman comes up to me and she says, Mr. Alexander, I have a letter for you. It's a letter from a 12-year-old boy who's in eighth grade. And he's telling me how much he enjoyed reading The Crossover and how he had never read a book until he read mine. And it was a really touching letter, so touching that I decided I was going to show up at his school and surprise him. And when he came out of class, I just began to recite the poem.
Okay, we have some sound there.
You have it?
Yes, okay. And his name his name is Seanwell. He's this small for his eighth grade size.
Really
kid.
Small.
Looking up, but who's this guy? You know, he just, and so here you are reciting. Let's listen.
If anyone else called me fresh and sweet, I burn mad as a flame, but I know she's only talking about my game. See, when I play ball, I inspire. So hoop for sale, and what? I'm the buyer.
He knows the words.
What's up, man?
He's looking at you.
And now I'm introducing myself.
You're Kwame Alexander? Kwame Alexander? Yeah. I read your book, The Crossover.
Crossover!
Yes. I read your book! Oh my God! You're not the
best!
You know, it's sweet tea!
It was like I was Lenny Kravitz or something. And I was a rock star for that moment. And the kids were just electrified by the fact that the author of their favorite book was literally right in front of them.
Oh, my God. He had to run to get all his friends.
He did.
How'd that make you feel?
That's the best feeling in the world. Winning the awards, you know, making a bestsellers list are things that are life-changing for me. Seeing that kind of response, seeing the life-changing impact of words on a kid like Seanwell, you know, that's the work. And that makes it all worth it.
Yeah. It's just, it's a lovely moment. So how do we get other kids to connect the way he did? Obviously, give them a book, you know, give the book, Crossover, or the Playbook, the new one. But how do you get kids who may not even, they may not even want to open it now? They're so tied to electronics.
Yeah. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I deal with that all the time.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, she wants to be on the iPad or she wants to watch Netflix, and I get it. I mean, I like to think if you can find a book that offers entertainment and inspiration, I think that you can find a way to empower kids through those books. So I have this mantra that I believe books are like amusement parks, and sometimes you got to let kids choose the rides. And so we were on our way to Hawaii for vacation recently, and on the plane, I had a copy of Out of the Dust, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and March Book 3 for my daughter to read. And I was like, these are the books you got to read. You need to read a chapter for every 15 minutes of screen time on this plane because it was a long flight. And she said, well, I want to read Raina Telgemeier's Ghost and Smile and Sisters, which are these amazing graphic novels. But my position was, you've read them 11 times. Now it's time to read something else. And she said to me, you don't believe in the things you speak about. I thought you said books were amusement parks and sometimes you got to let kids choose the rides. And I was like, oh, no. She threw my words back on me. And I think, and she was right, of course. But here's the deal. You want kids to get excited and engage with books? Give them a book that they want to read. Give them a book that they think is going to be awesome. Allow the literature to be a bridge to get them to appreciate all the books that you want. But it has to start with their imagination, their excitement. And I posit that a great way to do that is through poetry.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, first of all, the book that this young man just, you know, had fallen in love with, The Crossover. I want to talk about your new book, too, but The Crossover. Yes, a novel, but in poetry form. Yeah, about basketball, but not. I mean, here's a portion. The inside of Mom and Dad's bedroom closet is off limits. So every time JB asks me to go in there to look through Dad's stuff, I say no. But today when I ask Mom for a box to put my dreadlocks in, she tells me to take one of her Sunday hat boxes from the top shelf of her closet. And I'm pulled in there, and that is not basketball right there. What were you trying to get across?
I was trying to talk about family and friendship and sibling rivalry and jealousy and first love. Those were the things that mattered to me and my friends when I was growing up. And I posit, just because we don't see boys expressing themselves freely and willingly doesn't mean they're not thinking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I want to write stories about those things that are inside of all of us, especially the boys. And of course, how am I going to do it? Well, I got to use a little bit of trickery, I guess. So I got to frame the story in something else that I love that's authentic for boys in particular and kids in general. And that is sports,
yeah.
Basketball and tennis and soccer.
So in Crossover, the dad in the family is sick in a coma. And then I just love this late in the book chapter, I guess you'd call it. Mom, since you asked, I'll tell you why I'm so angry. That's the title. Because Dad tried to dunk. Because I want to win a championship. Because I can't win a championship if I'm sitting in this smelly hospital. Because Dad told you he'd be here forever. Because I thought forever was like Mars, far away. I mean, you let this character express his anger.
One of the things that I've always found really comforting is to be able to express myself through words. If I'm dealing with, you know, love or the wonders of the world, or I'm dealing with loss or the pains of the world or anger, whatever I'm dealing with, the words allow me to be able to put it in a context that helps me better deal and cope and understand it and act on it. And I think that's what's happening, at least with Josh in this story, is he has to find a way to deal with the woes of his world. And he has to find a way to make his way back to the joys of the world. Life is short, and you got to figure out a way to say yes to life and embrace it because it's not going to be here that long. And that's one of the messages that I think this book brings.
Well, and then there's the playbook, 52 rules to aim, shoot, and score in this game called Life. And we learn a little bit about you. It's a little memoir, you know. In eighth grade, I wanted to walk down the hall and get high fives, daps, and hollas. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be the man. And you decided, after your friend Vince suggested it, it was going to be basketball. So there's a big buildup. You're going to throw the ball at the half-court line. There's going to be newspaper clippings about you. Everyone will know, if I make it, you're trying out. If I make it, everyone will know, Kwame Alexander, I don't make it.
So first of all, thank you for bringing back that painful memory. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Secondly, I remember being nervous bringing the ball up the court, and I remember getting benched after that. And I remember being really disappointed. Mm. But I also remember finding my way to tennis, finding my way to the sport that would eventually become not necessarily the coolest sport, but it would make me into the coolest guy at school, at least in my eyes.
Isn't that all that matters, by the way? That you felt good about yourself.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so I always believing that you're a star in your mind and day and night letting it shine, regardless of how other people feel. Because here's the thing. if you walk like you've got gold mines at the meeting of your thighs, that's a Maya Angelou reference, then people will have no choice but to respect your shine. And if they don't, forget about them. Kids got to believe in themselves. They got to dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, swish. They got to do that. And they got to know they can do it.
Hmm. Kwame Alexander, author of the playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in this game called Life. Also, The Crossover. I highly recommend it. Kwame Alexander, thank you so much. We look forward to Solo coming out in August. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, and that is his upcoming book in August. We're going to have Kwame back to talk about that. It was partly inspired by him seeing that iconic scene in Say Anything when John Cusack lifts a boombox above his head and plays Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes to the girl he loves. Cannot wait. Meantime, we'll have excerpts from his current books at hereandnow.org, where we'd love to see your choices for great summer reading for teens. Maybe Rainbow Rowell's Carry On, or When Dimple Met Rishi, Sandhya Menon. Maybe a classic? Let us know. A couple of hair salons in Nashville are looking to help the environment, joining others, not just sweeping up hair clippings and trashing them, but recycling them. Amy Eskind of Here and Now contributor WPLN reports.
We are taking off about 2 inches? About 2 inches.
Heather McCullum is shaping a bob at Fruition, a hair salon she co-owns in Nashville. As soon as the cut is finished, she goes into collection mode.
Cleaning my chair of all of the hair that I just cut off of Joan Turley.
McCullum carefully marches a dustpan full of hair to the back of the salon where she keeps her recycling operation.
I know it sounds really gross and weird to be recycling hair, but it's really amazing that we can recycle something so simple and help save the planet.
In an industry dedicated to beautifying, hair salons have been degrading Mother Nature. Chemicals are poured down the drain and enter the water supply, and waste bins are filled to the brim with bottles and tubes of hair products and foils, which end up in a landfill. McCullum says it has always bothered her.
I've owned a salon for 13 years, and I've always felt a little guilty about all of the gross waste that comes from a salon.
Now a young company from Toronto promises they can help hair salons reduce their waste by a whopping 95%. Green Circle Salons recycles chemicals, tubes, and foils, and yes, hair. Hundreds of salons across the country are sending their hair clippings to warehouses in Chicago and Seattle, and Jennifer Henry says the company takes it from there.
We make sure that we pull out all the bobby pins and foreign objects. Oftentimes we get, you know, little bits of trash and wrappers and papers and things in there. So we pull all that out.
The hair dries in repurposed burlap coffee sacks. Then it's boxed up for shipping. The clippings add up.
We get about 3 tons of hair into our warehouse every month. It's a mountain of hair.
Henry says one plan for those mountains of hair, oil spill cleanup.
If you imagine what happens to an animal in an oil spill, you see its fur and or its feathers just gets coated in oil. What we know is that human hair has those exact same properties. Hair is incredibly absorbent, and human hair wants oil. It's just a natural property of the fiber.
After the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, the company sprang into action. They sent what little hair they had collected in their first year to volunteers on the shorelines who stuffed it into pantyhose to make hair booms.
You kind of push it around on the surface for a minute or two, and everything that it touches just automatically clings to the hair and just disappears. It goes right in.
Currently, hair booms are not commonly used to clean up oil spills, though Henry says she hopes they will become widely accepted because they work better than synthetic booms. Meanwhile, Green Circle continues to search for more ways to reuse hair clippings.
Hair is a very high-performance material.
That's Justin Barone, an assistant professor in the Renewable Materials Laboratory at Virginia Tech. He made a splash using chicken feathers to replace some of the oil in plastic, and he says human hair works just as well.
Keratin-based materials are always kind of on the outside of organisms. They make up hair and feathers and horn and hooves and fingernails. And so it is a very, very strong and tough material. If you can collect it in some way and use it, you will end up with a very good plastic material.
Using 80% traditional plastic and 20% human hair, Barone says he is making, what else? a recycling bin. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Eskind in Nashville.
The Trump administration is continuing its attack on so-called fake news. Today, the president tweeted a number of times criticizing The Washington Post, The New York Times, and others for writing what he said were false stories. And yesterday, during a White House press briefing, Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders also went after the news media when she was asked about a recently retracted CNN story about former Trump transition official Anthony Scaramucci. She responded by criticizing CNN and the media in general for producing a, quote, constant barrage of fake news. That led to a contentious exchange with Brian Karam, the executive editor of the Montgomery County Sentinel, a suburban weekly. Here's the exchange, starting with Huckabee Sanders.
If we make the slightest mistake, the slightest word is off, it is just an absolute tirade from a lot of people in this room. But news outlets get to go on day after day and cite unnamed sources, use stories without sources, have, you know, you mentioned the Scaramucci story where they had to have reporters resign.
Come on. You're inflaming everybody right here, right now with those words. This administration has done that as well. Why in the name of heavens? Any one of us, right, are replaceable. And any one of us, if we don't get it right, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us.
I think you have
been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions.
Right.
We're here to provide the answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everybody else out here is fake media. And everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
I disagree completely. First of all, I think if anything has been inflamed, it's the dishonesty that often takes place by the news media. And I think it is outrageous for you to accuse me of inflaming a story when I was simply trying to respond to his question.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what did you make of that exchange? It seemed that this reporter was speaking for a lot of reporters who have just had enough of the Trump attacks on the press.
Here we are again. You have Trump, somebody speaking for the Trump administration who is conflating a lot of critiques of journalism and suggesting that somehow makes journalism illegitimate. You know, one of the things you heard her there essentially imply was, my goodness, we're up here and people are allowed to say things against us that are not sourced perhaps in the way that that you might want in every instance. But yeah, the First Amendment allows a lot of reporting and a lot of journalism. And if you are a public official, a public servant, that's going to be part of the job. You know, what she's essentially saying is that she resents that people are in there and asking questions that are inconvenient, presenting them with stories that are undesired, and that essentially she wants to control the tempo and the rhythm of that room because that is, after all, the White House press room and the White House gets to dictate the terms. And yet it's not a private domain. It's a public one. So there is a tension there, and you've heard that thrown into very sharp relief by virtue of that exchange yesterday.
There have been a lot of questions about the White House daily press briefings recently, including some regular confusion about when the briefings will be scheduled and whether people will be able to turn cameras on or record what is being said. What's going on here?
There's an ongoing battle over the rules of engagement, over what the press corps is going to be allowed to have in terms of access on the record to Trump administration officials and spokespersons, and also what they're going to be able to convey to the public and how much of that's going to be able to be transmitted in real time. And you know, there are times where this feels a little bit like a fight between the NFL or Major League Baseball and sports writers who work for outlets that aren't the main broadcasters. Can you show clips during the game itself? Like, what access do you have? Well, this is the government. We're supposed to have a degree of access. Now, you can rightly say that it was the Clinton administration that turned on the cameras for, you know, press briefings on a routine basis to show live images. And that in some ways did transform the nature of that briefing. But it is rare to have a walk back of transparency once granted on a level for a significant period of time. That's what you're seeing here. I also think the administration finds it useful to be in these fights with the press. The press has emerged as one of their key antagonists, so it's useful to have the press as a foil. So they, you know, why bother yielding and giving in to the press on something when they think it's helpful to have the fight?
Well, there are some who believe that members of the news media should just keep the cameras rolling and ignore the administration's demands.
Look, if you do that, you know, the likely repercussion will be that they won't allow in people with cameras except on those events that they're going to intend to be televised, or that they'll take people's cell phones away or do something else. I don't have any problem with people trying to tape places they've been told not to tape in some sense, but I'm not sure that that's what gets you there. To be honest, the most important reporting on the administration and on the White House doesn't occur in that room. It occurs away from it. It occurs with people who are not reliant on formal access, but who are burrowing down and getting documents, getting sources, getting information, and getting that to the public. But there is something very important about public transparency and accountability occurring.
Let's get to that now retracted CNN story about Anthony Scaramucci, who's a former Trump transition official. CNN has since apologized. Three journalists resigned. What exactly did they get wrong, and how serious was this?
Such an interesting question. CNN has retracted the story and apologized for it exactly as you said. And yet people at CNN are not necessarily saying the story was wrong. They're saying the story was not vetted and did not hold up to their standards review practice. Scaramucci questions of his interactions with figures with a Russian investment fund at a time that he was also serving as a liaison on the Trump transition team was said by a single anonymous source to have come under the review of a Senate investigative panel on Russia and such matters. You know, I do think it's fair to say that almost any member of Trump world, whether the transition, the government, an informal advisor, who has ordered Russian dressing in the last year will probably come under some kind of review. I think people at CNN just felt this is not sustainable if we're intending to do aggressive reporting in the future that will stand up against the president's rhetorical attacks.
Well, on the one hand, this is why we are careful every single day on every single story to make sure that the facts are correct and that they're backed up and that we're being fair, because one mistake like this that somebody notices is going to be a major problem. On the other hand, journalists are going to make mistakes. How do they handle those mistakes when they make them? Is this the right thing to do? You fire a few journalists?
Yeah, technically they resigned, but it was clear that I think that executives felt their positions were not tenable anymore. Journalism is a human endeavor. It's a mortal endeavor. We make mistakes. And the real question is how you address those mistakes when they happen. I think CNN could have been more transparent itself in exactly what happened and what went awry. My reporting suggests that Eric Lischblau, who is a Pulitzer winner for The New York Times, who came aboard at CNN only recently, he had edited an earlier story for which he shared a byline in which CNN wrongly reported that former FBI Director James Comey was going to contradict President Trump in saying that when Trump had said that he had been assured by Comey that he wasn't under investigation. In fact, Comey testified that he had given him assurances that he wasn't under investigation for counterintelligence concerns. And as Lischblau had edited that, I think that put a greater degree of scrutiny or a greater degree of attention on Lischblau's role. But, you know, three people left. I think that the mistake that they seem to have made would not under normal circumstances cost one's job. I think it would be a reprimand. I think it would be a retraction and a big black eye. This was something where CNN thought, you know, we can't do that at this time. We have to do, you know, CNN feels that it's not fighting the administration. It's trying to hold it accountable, but it's trying to do it, you know, through this new investigative team with aggressive reporting. If they get things wrong, it's going to expose them to these attacks, as you've seen in recent hours.
David, one more thing I want to ask you about. Yesterday, when Republicans decided not to have their vote on the Senate health care bill this week and wait until after the 4th of July recess, that was a big story. Everybody was covering it. We were covering it. FoxNews.com's main story, you couldn't even find that healthcare story on the page. It was that Obama is taking lavish vacations. What do you make of that?
it's a clear effort by Fox News to avoid the difficult story. Right now, Fox is in a tough place. It's playing defense. There was a polls out showing that support for the Senate bill appears to be in something like the single digits across the country. This is a very unpopular stance even among independents and many Republicans. And this is not a fun issue for them to be trying to play defense on. They're going to go casting about the landscape to find some familiar target to direct attention to.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
The UN has declared 2017 the International Year of Sustainable Tourism, and just in time to celebrate a new adventure travel app that's part environmental guide, part competition. It's called Adventure Junkie. It's from Australian adventurers Fuchsia Claire Sims and Nigel Malone, who wanted to give environmentally conscious travelers some tools. And Fuchsia Claire Sims joins us by Skype from Sydney, Australia. Welcome.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. Well, that would be one place I'd want to go, Australia. But we understand the content for the app is user-generated. People send stuff in. They submit trips, and your staff curates it. And the trips, what, they can't leave a big mark on the planet?
Yeah, look, it's really important for us that not only the adventures people are doing are obviously really high on experience and exciting, but equally that they're as low on impact as possible.
Well, how do you do that? Because, you know, there are some people who say, do not travel because it's the emissions from airplanes and cars and trains that, you know, are leading to global warming. But then others say, no, travel is a driver of the economy in countries that need the tourism. So obviously you fall down on the travel side. But how do you limit your footprint?
One of the first things we did is we looked at best practice. And we've been doing a lot of work with a group called the Adventure Travel Trade Association, and they've helped us set up some really true guidelines around, you know, the types of adventures we're looking for. So it's about buying local, how are staff treated, looking at different awards and accreditations that operators and particularly even destinations have in place for how they're handling tourism. So we're always looking for, I guess, the hero destinations and regions that are making a big effort in this regard. Because it's important when travelers come to a destination that that experience holistically is being done very well.
Right. You don't want to arrive on your trip and find out that there are protesters standing there because you're interrupting an animal migratory pattern.
Absolutely. And that's where we like to empower our users.
We know you're not as interested in the trips that everybody makes because there are some areas that are over-traveled.
Yes. And I mean, I think that's one of the funnest parts of particularly being involved in this business. And that's when I wake up and I can see some of these incredible experiences that are being added by my users, you know, from volcano surfing in Nicaragua.
Wait. Volcano surfing?
Yeah. So you literally climb up these volcanoes. I don't think they're active.
Okay.
And you will put yourself on a board and go zooming down the side of the hill.
Whoa. Tell us some others.
You know, and equally, it's not just extreme things. You know, there's things like walking a butterfly trail in Mexico, spending time on glaciers in Iceland and talking to geologists and really understanding what's going on with the environments around you. Another really great example is spending time with cultures. So sitting in Namibia with the Himba tribe and looking at their way of life and understanding their values.
Now, talk about the competition part. People can follow others. They can form tribes, but they compete. How does that work?
Games are really fun, and we're trying to help our audience be recognized for their adventurous achievements. When you go and do these adventures, and every single one of these on our site, we've given a point score. So once you complete an adventure on our system, you'll earn those points, and you'll move up a leaderboard. And yes, it's really friendly rivalry. You can choose to create a tribe of your friends, or equally, you can really try charging out there and go on and try and conquer Earth's number one adventure junkie.
By the way, who's number one right now?
There's a really interesting scientist called John Collins, and he goes on these exceptionally interesting adventures into antiquity and really into some unusual places all around through Asia. He's currently in Mexico at the moment. But even in our top 25, we've got interesting characters. A top adventurer in Australia called Justin Jones. He kayaked from Australia to New Zealand. He's got a world record for walking to the South Pole and back. But he's also just your average guy because 6 months before he went on that, he didn't even know how to ski.
This is great. And by the way, people might be saying, well, how do you accrue points? How do you know? You've got your smartphone GPS that you can use or submit a photo, which means that you can also do this retroactively. If you've got pictures from, let's say, you're on top of Kilimanjaro a couple decades ago, that would be me, you can submit that?
You sure can. And it's funny you bring that up. We got a submission about a month ago from, 72. And it was someone actually going out spelunking in a canyon, and they had a photo of it.
Wow. Just a couple other trips that you can tell us about.
Kayaking with whales down in the Magellan Strait, which is in a tiny little island down in Tierra del Fuego at the bottom of South America. Crazy rivers to raft all through Austria. There's one called the Tyrol that's in absolutely crystal clear blue waters. Camping and photography and even festivals are really starting to come through the system a lot as well. And diving is a big one. Mm. And we also have interesting things that are like archaeological places like the Nazca Lines in Peru, or ecological things like glacial museums in Norway to, you know, street arts in the Mission of San Francisco. So it really is a broad, broad range. For us, I guess we define adventure as a combination of three things. So it's nature, culture, and physical activity, and going for those meaningful and authentic experiences that you can have in small, low-impact groups.
That's Fuchsia Claire Sims, one of the developers of the Adventure Junkie travel app, with her partner Nigel Malone. She joined us by Skype from Sydney, Australia. Fuchsia, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Jeremy, you love to travel. Hear anything you like?
I actually am late for my volcano surfing class. It's starting right now, so I can be ready for that.
I want to go to a blueberry festival. I'm tired. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with